and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the long history of crimes committed by Western scientists and pharmaceutical giants in Africa. These crimes have come into focus amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Since the outbreak, there have been concerns that history will repeat itself and Africans or people of African descent will be used by Western pharmaceuticals to conduct unethical clinical trials for COVID-19 drugs and vaccines. So join us till the end of the show as our experts give you an in-depth analysis on this issue affecting hundreds of millions across Africa.
Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa. Western countries have a long history of illegal and unethical medical testing in Africa. Medical colonialism is a chapter of colonial history in Africa that was not closed and is again in the news amid the COVID-19 virus ravaging many countries in the world. Early April last year, Jean-Paul Mira, head of intensive care at Cochin Hospital in Paris, put forward the idea that tests for coronavirus vaccinations should be carried out in Africa, where he claimed there are no masks and no proper medical care. The research director at France's National Health Institute, INSERM, agreed.
Alors vous avez raison, et d'ailleurs on est en train de réfléchir en parallèle à une étude en Afrique justement pour faire ce même type d'approche avec le BCG, un placebo. Je pense qu'il y a un appel d'offres qui est sorti, il va sortir, et je pense qu'on va en effet sérieusement réfléchir.
This suggestion outraged the director general of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom, himself an African from Ethiopia, who said that Africa will not become a testing ground for COVID-19 vaccines.
It was a disgrace, actually, and appalling to hear during the 21st century from scientists that kind of remark. And we condemn this with the strongest terms possible. But we assure you that this will not happen in Africa.
Clinical trials by Western pharmaceutical giants in Africa are not always conducted according to leading ethical guidelines. This puts clinical trial participants at risk of being physically harmed or having their rights violated. At the same time, excluding the continent from ongoing pandemic research is not the answer. Clinical trials can be ethically done, and many African countries and institutions now have ethics review boards to oversee medical research.
Amid reports that plans were afoot to conduct unethical COVID-19 vaccine trials in the country by Western research institutions, Kenyan president said that the country will only allow such trials if they follow internationally accepted protocols.
Once we have reached an area where these trials can be tested on humans, fellow Kenyans, as we have been briefing you on a regular basis, we shall keep you informed and we shall let you know, and nothing shall be done in the dark. You will be informed.
Now, for an incisive analysis on the unethical and criminal conduct of Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa, we are joined by Mustafa Traore, an academic, political analyst, and founder of AnOpenEye.org. We also have with us here Dr. Yurga Gelo-Waldeyes, a researcher and lecturer at the Curtin University's Center for Human Rights Education in Australia. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. And we start off with Mr. Gelo. Africa has, for over 100 years, been a testing ground for pharmaceutical companies from the West. They've been conducting unethical clinical trials for drugs. Now, clearly, medical experimentation is entrenched in the history of racism and colonialism. What's your take?
Thank you. I think that is true, because colonialism and racism is not simply the occupation of land and administering people and ruling them. For Africans, or generally for black people in particular, colonialism and racism has a particularly personal impact. They experience it in their body. So colonialism involves the colonization of the black body. The human body itself becomes a colonial property. Within that framework, colonial experimentations and the gathering of not just experimentation, but generally knowledge from Africans was conducted by treating the people as having no rights, no dignity or agency.
Thanks for that, Dr. Agelo. Now, can you give us examples on how colonialists used unethical means to conduct medical experiments on Africans?
We can take examples, for example, from Namibia in the early 90s, where sterilization techniques were applied on Herero tribes. We can take examples of controlling African populations using contraceptives such as Depo-Provera in Zimbabwean women and also in Ghana. We can also take examples where Africans were given the agents that causes trypanosomiasis or sleeping sickness without their consent and knowledge. All of these examples tell us or show us that colonial knowledge or medical knowledge was collected from Africa without the consent, without the participation of the people, in a way that also deprives the use of those medications or knowledges back to Africans.
Now, let's bring in Mr. Mustafa Traore. What's your opinion on unethical clinical trials by Western pharmaceutical companies on African people?
It seems that for some, in the past, black people, Africans, were the missing link between the monkey and human beings. So we know that scientists have always carried out experiments on animals first before trying the different medicines on human beings. So this is why it has been the case and for 100 years now, and it's still going on. So we've got to be very vigilant with what's happening right now at the moment.
Mr. Traore there says that Africans must be vigilant to stop global pharmaceutical giants from using them as guinea pigs. Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Even after the end of colonialism, Western countries, which claim to be champions of human rights, allow their pharmaceutical companies to conduct unethical trials on Africans. There appears to be no end in sight for these. Will this unfortunate trend continue?
That colonial exploitation was put into new systems. One good example could be the ways in which pharmaceuticals, for example, exercise a right of ownership over inventions that they acquire through experimenting on people.
The earliest reported unethical medical trials on Africans by Westerners were sterilization tests done on Herero women by German doctors. The Herero and Nama genocide was a campaign of racial extermination and collective punishment that the German Empire undertook in German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, against the Herero and the Nama people. It is considered the first genocide of the 20th century. It took place between 1904 and 1908. Despite being one of the richest countries in the world, Germany is yet to compensate the descendants of women who suffered unethical tests in the hands of German scientists during the colonial era. Why are Western countries refusing to take responsibility?
How can you understand that in France, you have people being paid to have babies, the government trying to encourage people to have babies, but at the same time, in some parts of France, because La Réunion is part of France, it's a kind of colony. You had people, or doctors, or scientists sterilizing women against their will. So there's something wrong here. So if we want to compensate, to repair what was done in the past, we've got to stop what we are doing right now.
The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Troven in Nigeria is cited as one of the outstanding examples of impunity by Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa. In 1996, Kano State in Nigeria suffered a major meningitis outbreak. Top United States pharmaceutical company Pfizer decided to conduct clinical trials to test a drug it was developing. Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa.
The drug had not yet been approved in the United States, where parents were not willing to put up their children as guinea pigs. Pfizer deliberately desisted from obtaining informed consent from the parents of the Nigerian patients. A Nigerian lawyer rejected the company's excuses that the studies were conducted through a deal with the Nigerian government.
At that time, the person, if there was any deal at all, was made by an individual against interest of a government, against interest of a nation. Do you, if you get what I'm saying? Now, forget about if any deal was done at all, it was individualistic deal. I don't want to hear about it. Pfizer ought to have known better. Can they do that deal in America? Can they do it in the UK or in any of the European countries?
Now, because of the adverse effects which the vaccine had on the children, including death and disabilities, the Nigerian federal government filed a suit against Pfizer and several of its employees in June 2007.
The government was seeking nearly $7 billion in damages for the deaths of children involved in the Trovan drug trial. In late January 2009, the Nigerian federal government informed the court that it has agreed with Pfizer to settle the lawsuit out of court.
We believe that the case that the federal government has against Pfizer is a good case. There's overwhelming evidence of Pfizer's misconduct. There's overwhelming evidence that Pfizer perpetrated all kinds of fraudulent activities and also engaged in this clinical trial illegally. There are victims who are living today. There are some families of the victims who have died who, what they understood at the time Pfizer came to Nigeria was that Pfizer was volunteering treatment. They did not think that they were volunteering their children as guinea pigs for a clinical examination.
In a move that surprised many, the parties agreed to a settlement figure of only $75 million. WikiLeaks cables suggest that Pfizer may have blackmailed the head of Nigeria's Ministry of Justice into dropping the multi-billion dollar criminal lawsuit. 24 years after the scandal, many victims are yet to be compensated and still can't live normal lives.
Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Do you think Western pharmaceutical corporations are taking advantage of poverty in some African countries by conducting unethical tests on their citizens?
They are not really poor. Poverty is not, lack of food or lack of shelter. That is destitution. Poverty is redefined as lack of what the West has. So how they operate is not because Africans are poor, but because they change the definition of poverty so that Africans will stop developing their own natural resources, will stop inventing what is relevant for them, will stop using their traditional and natural resources and knowledges to change their future, but instead wait for Western intervention to happen.
Thanks for that insight on destitution and poverty, Dr. Gelo. Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently raised concerns about the disinformation campaign and conspiracy theories circulating about COVID-19 vaccines.
While the country is in the process of procuring inoculations for its citizens as it fights the pandemic, anti-vaccine sentiments are being expressed by a number of people, including those in higher offices such as political leaders. Clearly, many Africans mistrust vaccines supplied by Western pharmaceutical companies, especially those that have a history of conducting unethical trials on Africans.
Dr. Gelo, is it true that incidents such as the Pfizer scandal in Kano, Nigeria, have led many to doubt even legitimate vaccines and thus negatively impacting on the overall health of the population?
That is a very good example, what happened in Nigeria on Nigerian children who had meningitis by this big corporation, raises the alarm that, you know, Africans are genuinely justified to doubt and are justified to ask strong guarantees, strong commitment that they will be beneficiaries. These experiences show us that there is no genuine desire to solve the problem of life, to solve the problem of Africans. The greatest drive is actually to acquire profit, to make more money. So there is a primacy of profit over the value of life. Within this context, then Africans are really justified to doubt.
Last year, there were protests in South Africa when the University of Witwatersrand, in partnership with the Oxford University, rolled out South Africa's first clinical trial. protesters say they did not want Africans to be used as guinea pigs, reflecting concerns among many in Africa over testing drugs on people who do not understand the risks.
I'm not happy at all. I mean, this feels like 1981 all over again, or in the 1980s all over again, when the AIDS pandemic just broke out in SA. It feels like the same thing. It's like a replay, but this time they're doing it in our face.
Mr. Traore, you earlier talked about vigilance in the face of unethical practices by Western pharmaceutical companies. Now, can you elaborate, especially in the context of the COVID-19 vaccine?
Keep on repeating it. Every bad thing that we do to African countries, okay, if it is accepted and if no one says anything, we are later going to do the same thing to our own population. So this is why we've got to be very vigilant, especially right now with the vaccines against COVID-19. Okay? So this is, we don't know what they have in their vaccines. We do not know. So I think, you know, when you have people in the world talking about reducing the population on Earth, you've got to be very vigilant.
Now, in a very selfish move in June last year, the U.S. government bought up virtually all the stocks for 3 months of remdesivir, which has proven to work against COVID-19. This immoral and unethical decision by the U.S. left none for the rest of the world, including Africans who are involved in its clinical trials. Now, Dr. Gelo, we saw how the U.S. prevented African countries from obtaining remdesivir in the fight against COVID-19, yet Africans were used in its clinical trials. What's your view on this?
A lot of Africans from Liberia, from Guinea, from Democratic Republic of Congo were participating in experimental treatment for Ebola. So this medicine was administered to them, and it is by that participation, through that process, that this medicine become accepted as harmless for humans and can be used now for COVID-19. But what we see after all of this happened is the company that has sole ownership over this invention, the company called Gilead, has now is kind of exercising the right to give patent to selected companies and countries, and it is really unlikely that Africans will have easy access to this medication.
Mr. Traore, some Africans are skeptical about COVID-19 vaccines being sourced from Western countries. Is there a reason to doubt these vaccines?
I think this is the West, and everyone loves Africa, but they do not love the Africans. So Africans have to be very careful with that. They have to be aware of that. So this is why this is a crime. We know that when you've got some Americans talking about the fact that we are too many of us on Earth, that we should limit or reduce the population on Earth, we know that the first target is the African continent. This is where you have all the resources.
Mr. Traore there believes that some of these COVID-19 vaccines are actually a ploy to wipe out Africans. What do you think? Let us know through our social media handle. Now, Mr. Gelo, you get to have the last word in our show today. Tell us, what should African countries do to prevent Western pharmaceutical giants from using the continent as a testing ground for their drugs?
People have become, disposables if they are not useful for the system. That autonomy which we envision through various kinds of mechanisms such as human rights and others are not really being observed because governments are not observing the dignity of human beings. They are interested rather in protecting the profits, property rights, patent rights of corporations and companies. And governments which are meant to serve their own population, especially the poor, are not carrying out their duties in the way they are expected according to these international agreements of human rights that they signed up to. So I think we need to come back to the human, to our own human sense of dignity, a dignity that we give to life, and respect that life is more important than profit.
Well, life is more important than profit. We hope governments and global multinationals will listen to that advice and stop exploiting people for profits. And with that, viewers, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all. And until next time, goodbye and take care.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador under President Donald Trump, who left the administration without the drama or ill will that marred most of its high-level departures, sharply criticized her former boss in an interview published on Friday, 12th of February, saying she was disgusted by his conduct on 6th of January, the day of the Capitol riot. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, Nikki Haley slams Trump's election claims. We shouldn't have followed him. Stay with us for more of Jeremy Peters' article. Nikki Haley, a former United Nations ambassador under President Donald Trump, who left the administration without the drama or ill will that marred most of its high-level departures, sharply criticized her former boss in an interview published on Friday, 12th of February, saying she was disgusted by his conduct on 6th of January, the day of the Capitol riot. Nikki Haley, a 49-year-old who is widely believed to be considering a run for president in 2024, told the website Politico she did not believe that the former president would remain a dominant force within the Republican Party, or that he would seek office again, arguing that he had lost any sort of political viability. I don't think he's going to be in the picture, Ms. Haley said. I don't think he can. He's fallen so far. Ms. Haley's comments predictably prompted a backlash from Donald Trump's loyal base of support, a constituency that most Republican office holders continue to try to appease, and one that she had assiduously tried to avoid offending since leaving his administration at the end of 2018. Before her latest comments became public, Nikki Haley seemed to realize that they would go too far for many Republicans, and it was not long before she bowed to the reality of Mr. Trump's enduring power within the Republican Party. In an interview with Laura Ingraham of Fox News Channel that was broadcast late last month, after Ms. Haley had spoken to Politico but before the article was published, Ms. Haley muted her criticism of the former president considerably. At some point, I mean, give the man a break, she said, condemning Democrats for pursuing a second impeachment against Donald Trump for instigating the 6th of January assault on the Capitol. I mean, move on, she added. Does he deserve to be impeached? Absolutely not. But the storming of the Capitol building last month and Donald Trump's role in inciting it with repeated false claims of ballot rigging in last November's election caused Ms. Haley to reassess her relationship with the former president. Her tone changed markedly between interviews with Politico in December and in January. At first, she refused to acknowledge that Mr. Trump was doing anything reckless by refusing to concede the election. She said that he genuinely believed he had not lost, and she would not acknowledge that his actions since the November election were irresponsible. And she wrongly predicted that Mr. Trump would go on his way once he had exhausted his legal options. But after the 6th of January riot, Nikki Haley told the publication that she had previously urged Mr. Trump to be more careful with his words, to no avail. "He went down a path he shouldn't have done," she said, referring to his deception about the election, "and we shouldn't have followed him, and we shouldn't have listened to him, and we can't let that ever happen again." In that moment, Nikki Haley's remarks showed that she was willing to entertain a political proposition that most other Republicans with eyes on the White House had not dared to utter publicly: that Donald Trump hold over the GOP base will loosen, and that he will not be the kingmaker that many have predicted. However calibrated or qualified, Nikki Haley's approach is a departure from that of other conservatives who are believed to harbor ambitions for higher office. Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, who lent credibility to Donald Trump's voter fraud claims, has refused to acknowledge that his own actions played any role in inciting violence on 6th of January. And former Vice President Mike Pence has said nothing publicly since being forced to flee the Senate chamber under armed guard as rioters stormed the Capitol building, encouraged in part by Donald Trump's attacks against the Vice President on Twitter for not interfering with the certification of the election. Nikki Haley was specially pointed about Donald Trump's treatment of Mike Pence, sounding almost dismissive of the former president as she expressed her dismay. "Mike Pence has been nothing but loyal to that man," she said. Some Republicans said that Ms. Haley's comments were simply acknowledging reality. As a politician who is more comfortable with the establishment wing of the GOP, she has not always had the trust of Donald Trump's base. And in a crowded 2024 presidential primary, she would face stiff competition from those votes. You didn't have to be clairvoyant to see which way Nikki Haley would go once Donald Trump lost, said Sam Nunberg, a consultant who worked for Mr. Trump. She was never going to be able to take the Trump mantle. To other Republicans, her words of regret were too little too late, given her earlier deference towards Donald Trump. Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, who has become one of the most outspoken critics of his party since the Capitol attack, accused Nikki Haley of playing both sides. On Twitter, he urged her to pick country first or Trump first. This is not Nikki Haley's first reversal on Donald Trump. Like many leaders of her party, she initially opposed him when he ran for the Republican nomination in 2016. At that time, she was the governor of South Carolina, and she endorsed Senator Marco Rubio of Florida ahead of her state's pivotal primary. Donald Trump still won, finishing ahead of Marco Rubio by 10 percentage points. But she redeemed herself in the eyes of many Republican voters by signing on to work in the Trump administration, showing how quickly old slights can be forgiven by the former president and his supporters.
The debate. Russia has warned that it's ready to sever ties with the European Union if the bloc hits Moscow with new economic sanctions. The EU reportedly plans to impose travel bans and asset freezes on allies of the Russian president in response to the last week's expulsion of German, Polish, and Swedish diplomats from Moscow. Tensions have risen recently over the arrest of Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny. Moscow says the West is exploiting Navalny's case for political reasons. The latest differences between Moscow and the EU could put pressure on the Nord Stream 2 natural gas pipeline being built from Russia to Germany. The United States has also imposed sanctions on companies working on the project. Once completed, Nord Stream 2 would double the flow of energy resources between Russia and Germany.
Russia and the EU have remained at odds over a host of issues for years. Tensions, however, between the two have escalated recently over the alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny and his ensuing imprisonment for violating a parole. Navalny's arrest upon his return from Germany sparked angry reactions in Europe and at home, with thousands of his supporters taking to the streets across Russia. Moscow slammed the rallies as illegal and expelled three European diplomats for attending the rallies. Russia says Navalny's case is an internal affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. However, Russia's move prompted tit-for-tat expulsions from Germany, Poland, and Sweden. And the EU foreign policy chief has called for a new round of sanctions on Russia.
First, we will discuss this issue at the Foreign Affairs Council on the next 22nd of February, at the European Union Council in March. It will provide guidance on the way forward, and it will be for the member states to decide the next step. But yes, this could include sanctions.
Russia has reacted strongly to the EU's call, saying it is ready to sever ties with the bloc if it goes ahead with its economic sanctions plan. The Kremlin says it doesn't want to isolate itself, but it has to be ready for the worst-case scenario.
We assume that we are ready to sever ties in case we see again, as we have felt more already, that sanctions create risks for our economy are imposed in most vulnerable areas. Yes, if you want peace, prepare for war.
The Navalny case is just a tip of the iceberg in sinking relations between Moscow and Brussels. Among other things, they have been widely at odds over Russia's support for anti-government forces in eastern Ukraine and reunification of the strategic Black Sea peninsula of Crimea with Russia. Several European countries and the United States have accused Russia of blocking any solution to the conflict in eastern Ukraine. Russia, however, blames Ukraine for failing to implement the 2015 Minsk agreement that was aimed at putting an end to the conflict. It seems that a current diplomatic spat could be counterproductive for both Russia and Europe, as the two need each other for trade, particularly natural gas. Moscow is building a new pipeline that would bring gas to several European countries, undercutting Ukraine as a transit country. As expected, the U.S. is opposed to the project, claiming it will increase the bloc's energy reliance on Russia. Washington has imposed several rounds of sanctions on the companies involved in the construction of the project. Germany, which has always resisted a direct confrontation with Russia, has fought hard to keep the pipeline going, saying it is a commercial, not a political issue. Despite increasing tensions between the EU and Russia, many European leaders have already signaled they are not quite interested to see a deepening of a standoff with Moscow. It remains to be seen if tensions could spiral out of control as the new U.S. administration and some of its European allies seem hell-bent on declaring Russia as a major challenge.
Well, joining us on this debate, we have historian, journalist, and author Dr. Markus Papadopoulos, who's with us from the British capital, London. Also, we have research fellow at American University in Moscow, Gilbert Doctorow, joining us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Dr. Papadopoulos. Strong words from the Russian foreign minister, who says that Moscow should be prepared for the worst. Now, just recently, Sergei Lavrov said that the EU is not a reliable partner, at least at the current stage. Where is this heading? In your opinion, is this a new low for Russia-EU ties?
Well, when Britain departed from the European Union, there was a chance, albeit a slim one, that relations between the EU and Russia could improve. Why? Because when Britain had been a member of the EU, the British had constantly pressurized Germany and France, which are the engines of the European Union, to adopt a severe stance on Russia. in plain terms, we can say that when Britain had been a member of the European Union, the British were lobbying and lobbying very hard on behalf of American objectives in the EU. Now, since Britain has left the EU, the decisions of the European Union vis-a-vis Russia have hardly been conducive to improving relations between Brussels and Moscow. And indeed, the focal point at the moment concerns the EU's stance, completely unreasonable, unsubstantiated stance, on Alexei Navalny. Now, we have to ask, why is that? The European Union, as it stands today, is at its most fragile, politically and economically. And it is certainly not in the interests of the overwhelming majority of EU member states, with the notable exception, of course, of Poland and the Baltic states, for relations between the economic bloc and the Russian Federation to deteriorate even further. However, it certainly is in the interests of the Americans and the British for relations between the EU and Russia to deteriorate even further. Ultimately, the European Union is a strategic ally to America. The European Union coordinates its foreign policy and its defense policy with America, so much so that we can argue and argue persuasively that America is the outside dominant force in the European Union. So it is, in my estimation, that the Americans and the British have exploited the incident concerning Alexei Navalny to bring about a further worsening of relations between the European Union and Russia, because Washington and London do not want an improvement in relations between the EU and Russia.
Right. Let's cross over to Brussels now, Mr. Dugtaro. Last week, EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell said that his meeting with the foreign minister Lavrov highlighted that Europe and Russia are drifting apart, and that it seems that Russia is progressively disconnecting itself from Europe. Do you think that there's any place for constructive dialogue at the current moment right now?
I think what's needed is shock therapy. And this is exactly what Lavrov's words were meant to do yesterday. Just let's keep in mind that Mr. Lavrov is a very capable and very seasoned diplomat at global level. At the same time, the direction of his actions, the directions of his words, are given by Mr. Putin. And behind his remarks about preparing for war, if you want to have peace, we can see very clearly the thinking and the direction of Vladimir Putin. The point here is that Russia and the EU have been drifting apart for the last 10 years. Going back to 2012, when the European Union declined to renew its overall cooperation and strategic partnership with Russia, there has been a downward movement. It's lurched at various points. Of course, the 2014 events in Crimea and the Ukrainian civil war were one important turning point, or I should say lurch, backwards in the relationship. But there have been others. The Skripal poisoning was one. The MH17 was one. And they all have something in common. And that something in common, and here's why I differ a bit with the previous speaker, is a script written in Washington. If the UK has been the voice of skepticism, if not hostility to Russia within the EU, that was all acting in a nod and a wink with what it was receiving by way of recommendations from Washington. The Poland and the Baltic states are the cat's paw of the United States within the EU, and they are effective precisely because the way it is structured today, the EU cannot have a foreign policy that is worth anything. Everything must be based on consensus. Any naysayer can destroy that consensus and deprive the EU of a policy. We are in a situation where these Baltic states and Poland are depriving the major powers in Europe of logical, reasonable relations with Russia. At the same time, Mrs. Merkel is not an innocent bystander in this. Germany has had its own very clear interests as a major power in Middle Europa, as where German industry is heavily installed ever since these countries became free of the East Bloc. And Germany is in a love affair with these countries and does not find it very simpatico, very, very easy to deal with Russia. Russia is too big, Russia is too strong. And so it is very easy for Mrs. Merkel and her party and Germany to stand aside and let the Poles and the Baltics do all the nasty words about Russia and appear to be calm and reasonable. Germany is not being calm and reasonable. Its present policy of encouraging Mr. Navalny, of giving him all support when he made his fake news video during his stay in Germany, this is not the act of a friendly power or even a neutral power. It's the act of a hostile power.
Okay.
So Germany has also become an active contributor to the deterioration in relations with Russia.
Back to London, Dr. Papadopoulos. Following the expulsion of the three European diplomats, the EU has hinted at imposing new sanctions against Moscow. Of course, that's a decision that needs to be approved by European governments. How do you view that approach from Brussels?
Well, I believe that that threat from the European Union actually originates in Washington. Because as I said moments ago, the European Union, even before what is known as COVID-19, was in an economically precarious condition. And relations with Russia, trade relations, investment relations, are very important to the European Union. It is simply not conducive to the economic well-being of the European Union for there to be EU sanctions on Russia, which stem from 2014, when the European Union, in tandem with America and Britain, initiated and implemented a coup against the then Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych. And as a result of the EU sanctions on the Russian Federation, many jobs and companies in the European Union, for example in Spain and Italy and Greece, have been seriously jeopardized because they're no longer able to export to the European Union. So if we speed forward to 2021, how on earth is it in the interest for ordinary people, ordinary companies in the European Union, for the EU to place further sanctions on Russia? Because that will mean that agricultural companies in the EU will be even more impeded in their ability to export to the European Union. So that is why my submission is that behind the EU's threats stands America and also Britain. Of course, Poland and the Baltic states are enjoying the deterioration in relations between Brussels and Moscow because the Baltic states and Poland are vehemently anti-Russian and are doing all within their means to act as a conduit for Western aggression against Russia. Let us not forget that last summer, when the West attempted to engineer a coup in Belarus, or Belarus, that is, as it is officially known as, Poland and the Baltic states acted as the logistical countries in that attempted coup. So the European Union is not truly an independent or sovereign economic bloc. Ultimately, it bends to the will of the Americans.
Same question to Gilbert Dottaro. Have European sanctions been working on Russia?
Well, let's be very clear, because this has not come out in the discussion until now. Mr. Lavrov's statement was explicit. He was not speaking about just any sanctions. He was speaking about sanctions that threaten the vital economic interests of Russia. Now, what does that mean? We don't have to guess. There are two sanctions which could threaten the economic well-being of Russia, and they are first pulling the plug on SWIFT, kicking Russia out of SWIFT, the International Settlement Organization for Financial Transactions, and the second is putting a halt if not permanently stopping the Nord Stream 2 project. The Nord Stream 2 project is the lesser of these two threats to Russia, but it's also very significant. And I'd like to make a small correction to the remarks at the introduction to this program. The Nord Stream 2 pipeline is not going to give additional gas to Europe. It will replace pipelines which have been through Ukraine, which are a means for the United States to threaten a European gas supplies and Russian ability to deliver gas at any moment. So it is providing the Nord Stream 2 would provide a reliable transit of gas to Europe. But coming back to SWIFT, that would be a deadly threat to the Russian economy and in Iran. You certainly know what this means. Unlike Iran, which did not have the capability of doing damage to those who are imposing the sanctions on it, since petroleum is not as vital or as limited in its supply and in its transport as gas is, Iran did not have a leverage that the Russians have. If the Europe were to implement what was called 2 years ago the nuclear option, that is, throwing Russia out of SWIFT and doing vast damage to the Russian economy, the Russians could do vast damage to the European economy on 2 minutes' notice by stopping the shipment of all gas to Western Europe. If they did that in the middle of Europe, in the middle of the European winter, then all hell would break loose here. So I think that by speaking as he did yesterday about cutting relations, what exactly does that mean? Does it just mean throwing out diplomats, or does it mean really cutting relations? Gas is the single most important element in European-Russian relations, and it would be entirely logical that the Russians would have their finger on that button if the SWIFT cutoff were cut to come to the fore in the European Parliament.
Dr. Papadopoulos, we're talking about the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. Despite the souring of ties with the Kremlin, Germany is going ahead with the Nord Stream 2 project. On the issue, the German president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, said, quote, energy ties are almost the last bridge between Russia and Europe. The foreign minister, German foreign minister Heiko Maas, also said, we must not burn all bridges with Russia. Supporters of this pipeline say that it's an economic project, not a political one, and it shouldn't be used as leverage. What is your perspective on the issue?
Indeed. And therein lies the reason, the ultimate reason, as to why a severing in economic relations between the European Union and the Russian Federation is highly unlikely. On the other hand, a severing in political relations between Brussels and Moscow is possible, but I believe it is inconceivable that there would be a severing in relations between an economic severing in relations between the European Union and Russia. Why? Because Russia needs the European market, and in particular the German market, to export its natural gas to. That is absolutely critical to the Russian economy. And likewise, the vast amounts, the vast majority of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. And when it comes to Germany, Germany is heavily dependent on the Russian Federation for natural gas. If Russia turned off its gas supply to the European Union, then the European economy, and the German economy in particular, would almost collapse overnight. And how would ordinary Germans and Europeans be able to survive the autumn and winter months? How would they be able to keep warm in their homes when there is no longer Russian natural gas coming into the European Union? So Sergei Lavrov, who is not a member of Putin's inner circle, he is a messenger, albeit a very capable one, has issued an exceptionally stern warning to the European Union to refrain from issuing those two sanctions on Russia. And I believe that the Europeans and ultimately the Americans understand that if Russia it did go ahead and sever all relations, political, but most important of all, economic, then the European Union would simply collapse. Where would Europe receive its gas from? How would European industry be able to function without Russian natural gas? So it is not in the interest for Russia to sever economic relations, and likewise, it is not in the interest for the European Union to no longer be in receipt of Russian natural gas.
Mr. Dottaro, following up on what our guest in London just said, is Germany basically making Europe more dependent on Russia?
Well, as I said, it's confusing the issue to speak about Nord Stream 2 as raising Russian supplies of gas to Europe. It's raising Russian supplies of gas directly to Germany, that's correct, but it does not change the balance of Russian contribution to the Europe-wide energy situation. It is simply removing Russian gas, or half of Russian gas supplied to Europe, from the fragile, politically vulnerable pipelines through Ukraine. It is in the interests of Russia to continue this, and the only purpose of Lavrov's warning was to remind them that Russia is not an insignificant country, is a major power, and must be treated with respect. It also was a reminder that the Russians take a very dim view of the whole Navalny promotion coming out of Europe. I think that we have to remember that within Russia's power structures, within Russia's political elites, and not just Mr. Putin and his narrow circle, but within the whole Russian power structure, there is a feeling of relief that Mr. Navalny finally has been treated as he should have been treated 2 or 3 years ago.
Okay.
There is the feeling that in trying to appear reasonable and civilized and decent and law and respecting human rights, the Kremlin has given the wrong signals to the West.
All right, I'm going to have to jump in there.
Confused.
Apologies, sir, we're running short of time. Thanks to my guest, historian, journalist, and author, Dr. Marcus Papadopoulos, joining us from London. Also thanks to research fellow at American University in Moscow, Mr. Gilbert Dottaro, joining us from Brussels. Also, special thanks to you for joining us on this debate. It's goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.